just 4 days after September 11, 2001, the program was designed to shoot down hijacked aircraft to avert another 9/11-style attack. The 1st Fighter Wing, with its 27th Fighter Squadron of F-22 Raptors, trained for a different mission. While the Noble Eagle aircraft patrolled the skies in and around Washington, D.C., the F-22s were tasked with intercepting incoming planes deemed a threat to the homeland while they were still in international airspace. The two $334 million machines rocketed through the clouds at 62,000 feet per minute, hitting Mach 2 and closed quickly with their target. Designed by Lockheed Martin with stealth as a primary requirement, their low radar cross-section and radar absorbent material rendered them all but invisible. At 40,000 feet, Langley handed off tactical control to the Eastern Air Defense Sector, headquartered at the Griffiths Business and Technology Park outside of Rome, New York. Targeting single on the nose, 80 nautical miles, Angels 37. Elvis communicated to his wingman using the 5th-generation fighter's intra-flight data link. A low probability of detection, low probability of interception communication system designed to augment the plane's stealth capabilities. Checkpointer. Painting a single, 80 out, Burbank replied via data link. Their mission was not simply to engage and confirm destruction. Their mission was to first conduct a flyby to ensure the target aircraft identified them as Americans, and then to blow it out of the sky. Switching from data to voice, the lead pilot said over the MIDS-J, the multifunction distribution system that allowed F-22s to communicate in VHF when stealth was not a primary concern. In this case, U.S. attribution was a mission requirement. Target aircraft is leaving U.S. airspace, not incoming, Burbank said. Charlie Mike, Elvis replied, using the military jargon for continue mission, as the two pilots closed the distance. Confirming remote ID, Elvis continued. Confirmed. Roger, remote ID verified, Burbank said. Visual confirmation of tail number required. Good copy, we don't want to get this one wrong. The two fighters closed on the Iranian business jet. Tally, Elvis said. Tally, his dash 2 confirmed. Elvis slowed his aircraft to keep pace with the large passenger jet and approached at its 8 o'clock. Tail number Echo Papa India Bravo Alpha, confirm. Burbank pushed his Raptor to the 4 o'clock. Confirm, Echo Papa India Bravo Alpha. This is it. Roger Burbank. Let's let them know we're here. Elvis and Burbank both hit their afterburners, passing the unique tri-jet configured aircraft within feet, before circling back around to take up positions on the starboard and port sides, close enough that they could see the panicked looks of the pilot and co-pilot in the cockpit. Burbank decreased his speed and visually confirmed that the windows were clear of passengers before throttling back up and taking up his position off the starboard fuselage. Elvis did the same on the opposite side of their target. Elvis, no passengers starboard side. Roger that, Burbank, one passenger port side. A national intelligence satellite captured the SATCOM transmission from the Iranian aircraft to Tehran. As with the targeted assassination of Admiral Yamamoto by American P-38s over Bougainville in 1943, the president didn't want to leave Iran with any questions as to who was responsible. That information was relayed to Eastern Air Defense Sector headquarters, who in turn sent an encrypted message to the F-22s. Target aircraft verified. Weapons read and free. Elvis confirmed receipt. The two F-22s fell back to 2 nautical miles and established the airspace was clear. Both aircraft locked onto their target. Standing by, Burbank said. Roger, Elvis acknowledged. Cleared hot, stand by. On my count, 3, 2, 1, Fox 3. 2 AIM-120C air-to-air missiles dropped from the internal weapons bays of their fighter aircraft, propelled forward by solid rocket fuel motors at Mach 4. Unlike Air Force One, this aircraft did not have countermeasures. And just like April 18, 1943, there would be no survivors. The first advanced medium-range air-to-air missile impacted the port wing. A millisecond later, the second missile hit mid-fuselage, igniting the fuel necessary for transatlantic flights and turning the Dassault Falcon 50 into a ball of fire over the Atlantic. Chapter 73. Mustique Island, Grenadines, West Indies.
"We need to come up with a plan, Eric," Senator Thwaites said, cutting into his lazy lobster.
They sat at opposite ends of a long rectangular table with a stunning view over the Caribbean east toward Barbados, just beyond the infinity pool. Sawyer offered a condescending smile that bordered on pity. He clamped his hand around the stainless steel tool and crushed the protective shell of his steamed Caribbean spiny lobster.
"You know you are eating that all wrong, Eddie," Sawyer replied, laying his seafood cracker on the table and using the long crab fork to pierce a section of the creature's succulent meat.
"You are just making a mess," Thwaite countered, "just like you did with this whole surveillance business."
Thwaite reached for his glass.
"Enjoy that, Senator. It's a La Chataigniere Saint-Auban Premier Cru 2017, perfect for this meal."
Thwaite took a large enough gulp he hoped would annoy his host.
"Well, we've been here for almost a month. I'm starting to go stir-crazy," Thwaite said, dunking a chunk of lobster into warm butter.
"Where would you prefer to go? Here you are all but invisible. You've seen the news. Everyone thinks you left town to avoid questions about illegal campaign contributions and conflict of interest issues."
"Those stories are planted. Christensen has the media in his pocket. They'll do anything for him, to include running false stories to ruin me."
"Regardless, it appears to me that the country is getting along quite well without you."
"Fuck you, Eric,"
Thwaite spat. "Remember, Senator, it was your ill-advised call to the president that tipped your hand. You were a bit too eager to save the country by dropping bombs on it."
"That fucking virus. How could it not be contagious?"
"If you were in your congressional seat, perhaps you'd be privy to classified briefings and might even know the answer to that question."
"Christensen probably orchestrated the whole thing just to give the country something to rally around and then ride in as their savior."
"With talk like that, you should probably embrace your new life as a retired expatriate."
"I can't stay here forever."
"You do what you'd like. You're not here free of charge. I'm keeping track."
"Oh, I know you are, Eric."
Mustique was a place one with means went to escape, to disappear. A private island situated between St. Lucia and Grenada, it rose to A-lister prominence in 1960, when the island's owner gifted 10 acres to Princess Margaret. Since then, the destination had hosted the likes of Queen Elizabeth, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Mick Jagger, David Bowie, and Tommy Hilfiger. The land, once the exclusive domain of royalty, entrepreneurs, and artists, was now being encroached upon by financiers and tech oligarchs. With no cruise ships anchored in the harbor, no paparazzi prowling the streets, and a strict no-drone policy, it remained a bastion for those in the jet-set crowd more concerned with privacy than society page stories.
"Lucky for you, my father was not a fan of government-imposed inheritance taxes. He made his money and wanted to keep it. He even made sure he passed away here."
"Lucky for you," Thwaite countered.
"Yes, he was a thoughtful man. Point being, you flew by private jet to Barbados, and we used a private charter to get from Barbados to Mustique, as the one runway here is too short for the jet. This plot of land was owned by my father and is now the property of a holding corporation that shelters it from anyone who might want to tie it to me or Masada."
"That may be, but I don't feel safe with only four of your goons on site for protection."
"Believe me, that is more than enough for Mustique. You are free to leave any time you desire."
"If I go back, I'll be questioned by the FBI. They probably already know about the FISA warrants. Your idea, I remind you. I'll be destroyed."
"Then maybe you just retire down here. You have enough to rent a shack or guest house."
"Fuck off, Eric. I just need time."
"Time for what?"
"Just time."
"You are not still spooked by that James Reese character, are you?
No. Well, yes, aren't you? He's a fucking madman, the president's personal assassin. We were close to proving it. You saw what he did to those men in Maryland. What was it, 10 people?
11, Sawyer corrected, turning his attention out to sea.
11, Jesus! 11 against one, Eric. And he killed them all.
Calm down, Senator. He is not coming to Mustique. He doesn't even know you are here. Trust me, you are safe.
Safe? I trusted you to eliminate him in D.C.
Actually, it was Virginia.
You failed, Eric. It was a simple mission, and you failed. Don't think for a second that a man like Reese will let that go.
You are right, Senator, and that is why I've taken measures to ensure we won't have to deal with James Reese ever again.
Oh, what are you talking about? Your goons couldn't handle him before. What makes you think they can handle him now?
Because I'm not using my goons, as you call them. There's a man who solves problems for me. A man whose only job now is to kill James Reese.
A problem solver. Like an assassin? Thwaite asked.
Just like that, Sawyer said.
Delightful, Thwaite acknowledged. Where is this man and when will it be done?
Patience, Senator. These things can't be rushed when dealing with professionals. Men like this are careful. They don't take chances or make rash decisions. They are calculated and discerning. That's how they stay alive.
Well, finally some good news, Thwaite said. In celebration, I think I'll pour myself another glass of your fine wine.
Chapter 74. Reese and Ox stepped from the small yacht tender and onto the dock at Basil's Bar. Live music cascaded from the deck where the Wednesday night band provided entertainment to residents, guests, and sailors. No one paid much attention to the two men dressed in the appropriate attire of those who belonged, beige slacks and tropical-colored button-down shirts. Ox wore a light tan jacket to ward off the breeze, and Reese had added a navy blue blazer, just in case he needed to melt into the shadows. The outerwear also helped conceal the suppressors attached to their subcompact pistols. The 80-foot catamaran moored just offshore belonged to a charter company owned by the CIA's maritime branch. The seaborne equivalent of ground branch, they reported to Vic Rodriguez's Special Activities Center and operated covered maritime assets around the world. The two operators ascended the steps to the main-level bar and passed among the dancing revelers, free to let loose with the bar's no-camera policy, knowing their pictures would not be plastered all over social media the following day.
"What do you want?" Ox asked as they approached the bar.
"Whatever you're buying," Reese replied.
Ox waited at the bar while Reese scanned the crowd. He was searching for someone.
"What can I get for you?"
a distinguished-looking black man asked. His hair was almost all gray, and he was dressed in a long, flowing white robe open to his chest. A beaming smile pushed his round glasses up off his cheeks, the soft lights that illuminated the bar reflecting off the thin lenses.
"What do you suggest, sir?"
Ox asked, scanning the selections.
"I recognize a kindred soul when I see one," the old man said. "How about a Hurricane David? Most powerful drink on the menu, blend of rums and vodka.
Since I can tell it's your first time here, I'm going to mix in a new Kohana rum from a friend in Hawaii. Mighty kind, I'll take two,"
Ox said. The CIA man turned back to Reese.
"See him?"
Reese nodded. Their target was not hard to find. Young, gelled hair, tight polo to show off his chemically enhanced muscles, covered with full-sleeve tattoos. He danced with a woman twice his age on the dance floor. Instead of a Patek Philippe or Panerai on his wrist, he sported a Casio G-Shock.
"I've got him," Reese said. "Here you go," the old man said from behind the bar, sliding the drinks across.
"Thank you, sir," Ox said, putting two 20s and a 10 in U.S. dollars on the bar.
"Thank you. Call me Basil. Enjoy your stay."
The former Delta Force Sergeant Major turned back to Reese and handed him the most expensive cocktail he'd ever purchased. The two operators moved to a darker corner of the bar, pretending to drink and enjoy a carefree conversation like the rest of the patrons. When the contractor they'd already nicknamed Muscles broke away from his cougar and sauntered across the floor, Ox looked to his partner.
"Ready to ruin his night?" he asked.
Reese set down his untouched drink and moved toward the restroom. 15 minutes later, the three men approached the driveway of Sawyer's Villa on the eastern side of the island, just south of Macaroni Bay. Muscles drove the Mule, a side-by-side four-person vehicle used by most island residents to go from the tennis courts to the beach, to Basil's.
"Like I said," Ox reminded Muscles, "you cooperate and you get immunity from whatever comes of this. If not, at the very best, you are entering into years of legal trouble where your opponent has government attorneys and you have to pay for yours."
"We are here for your boss," Reese said, "not you or your friends."
"I understand," Muscles said.
It hadn't taken much. A marshal badge and the recognition that two serious CIA operatives wanted a word with Eric Sawyer and his guest. The suppressed SIG P365 pistol Reese held as Ox explained the situation didn't hurt either. "Once again," Reese clarified, "we have no issues with you or your team. We just need you to stand down. If not, we will kill all of you, and I'll make sure you take the first bullet." Muscles swallowed hard and nodded.
"How about a cigar?"
Sawyer asked. "This one's on me. I won't even add it to your bill."
"That's generous of you," Thwaites said, his voice the epitome of contempt.
"The deck, then. It's a beautiful night," Sawyer said, rising from his chair and picking up a glossy black and red box from a wood sideboard filled with china.
The doors leading to the balcony that overlooked the pool and ocean were already open.
"I smoked my first cigar out here," Sawyer said, taking in the view. "We'd spend a few weeks here every season."
"You were a lucky fucking kid," Thwaites said.
"That is true,"
Sawyer conceded, opening the box and holding it out for his guest.
"What do we have?" Thwaites asked.
"Cohiba Spectre. Even I had a tough time finding them."
Thwaites picked a thick cigar from the box and ran it under his nose, closing his eyes to inhale the sweet nut and maple flavors of the exquisitely aged leaf.
"A woman is only a woman," he said.
"But a good cigar is a smoke,"
Sawyer added, completing the Rudyard Kipling line from The Betrothed.
"Ha! Isn't that the truth?"
the senator stated.
"Pass me your lighter, would you?"
Reese left Ox holding his weapon on the kneeling four-man contracted guard force and made his way up the stairs and down the hall. The contractors were the modern equivalent of mercenaries. Their loyalty was to the dollar. None of them were ready to die for their CEO. One way or another, their boss was going down. They were not about to drown with a sinking ship. Ox's Glock 43, along with zip ties reinforced with riggers tape, ensured they wouldn't have a sudden change of heart. At the end of the hall, Reese inched a tall door open. Two dirty dinner plates were at opposite ends of a long table. Hearing voices from the balcony, he moved toward his objective. A shadow warned them they were no longer alone. The blood drained from Thwaites' face and his hand fell to the armrest of his wicker lounge chair, the ash from his cigar dropping to the deck. Sawyer's natural reaction was to go for his pistol, but he recognized the intruder immediately and thought better of it.
"James Reese, what a surprise," the Masada CEO ventured, his voice masking an unease he hadn't felt since the streets of Mogadishu.
Reese moved onto the expansive balcony, weapon extended, a light breeze rustling through the fronds of the imported palm trees below. The two men sat in high-backed dark wicker chairs. A rattan coffee table was positioned between them, adorned with a massive glass ashtray. Reese redirected the pistol from Sawyer to the senator.
"This ends one of two ways, Senator. You either come back with me, or I spill your brains all over your friend's outdoor furniture."
"And what about him?"
Thwaite asked, pointing his partially smoked Cohiba at the whore of war across from him.
Oh, he's coming too.
Sawyer took a deep pull of his cigar, exhaling the sweet smoke into the island air.
How did you find me, Mr. Reese? I'm curious.
Trade secrets, Sawyer. You aren't quite as smart as you think.
Fascinating,
Sawyer said, making a mental note to fire his attorneys.
You can't just come in here and threaten me. I'm a sitting United States Senator, for God's sake.
Reese raised the pistol and watched Thwaite shrink back into the cushions of his chair.
You, Senator, are much more than that. You leaked a video extremely damaging to the security of the country. You also issued an order to kill me and a doctor trying to save the lives of almost 500,000 of our fellow countrymen.
I deny these